Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we present the final program in our 2018 Champlain Institute series, hosted by College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. Today's program features former Maine Senator George Mitchell. After his opening remarks, he'll discuss the role of immigration in America's history and in his own life. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear this program at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. You can also find it as a podcast. Introducing today's program is Darren Collins, president of College of the Atlantic.
Right now, I'm going to ask Ralph Nernenberger to come up after I give him a very short introduction. Ralph has helped shed light on peace and conflict throughout work in government, in the media, and through academic scholarship. And the bulk of Ralph's work has focused on understanding and working to improve relations in the Middle East, where he's worked with Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, Yasser Arafat, and scores of American businessmen and political leaders. Ralph was on the faculty of Georgetown University for 38 years. He now teaches at Florida Atlantic. He has been published widely in scholarly journals and reports and in media outlets across the United States. He served as foreign policy advisor to former Kansas Senator James Pearson and as a staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He founded and became the first director of Builders for Peace, and then founded a DC-based government relations firm, Nernenberger & Associates, that was back in 1994. Although the topics he works on are of the utmost seriousness in nature, he's a fun guy. I love him. He's a relaxed person. He's a great storyteller with great stories, and stories that range from the very, very local to the very global. Will you please help me welcome Ralph Nernenberger to the stage?
I'll talk about this wonderful week we have just had. One of the complaints a couple people raised during the question and answer period is some of the sessions made them rather depressed. My wife does not let me talk at parties because she says I depress people, and in fact, people walk away from me. It reminds me that the definition of a pessimist is someone who says things are so bad they cannot get worse, and an optimist is someone who says, of course they can. I attended a talk recently, and the speaker began by saying, before I speak, I'd like to say a few words. That's going to hit some of you on the way home. So I also realize that there isn't a single person in this audience who came today to listen to me instead of Senator Mitchell, and that includes my wife. So I will keep my remarks brief. I first met George Mitchell very shortly after he was appointed to the United States Senate in 1980 to complete the unexpired term of Senator Edmund Muskie, who had resigned in order to become Secretary of State. At the time, I was working for a lobby organization, and there were four lobbyists in this organization, and we divided up the House and the Senate, with each of us covering a quarter of the House and a quarter of the Senate, and we received our assignments. Sometimes if we knew someone, a member or a staff, we would be assigned to them. If we didn't, we each made a case for why I should go in to see this member and why someone else might go in to see somebody else. And I told my colleagues, I would like to go in and see this new guy because I have a background with Maine. I went to the University of Maine in Orono for two summers. I played the Maine tennis circuit, and I'll tell you a little bit more about my Maine background in a bit, but I can talk Maine with this new guy. So they said, fine. No one knew him, so it didn't make any difference. And they said, go in and see him. I remember coming back to our office after my first meeting with Senator Mitchell and telling my colleagues, this guy is really special. In retrospect, I totally understated the obvious. In fact, in my 40-plus years of working in Washington in and out of government, there is simply no one for whom I gained a greater respect and admiration than Senator Mitchell. And let me add, it's not just Senator Mitchell. Good members of Congress and Senate have good staff. Generally, bad members have bad staff. And I've gone in to see some staff, and you wonder, how did these people ever get that job until I met their member? Senator Mitchell had great staff, and I developed a long, lifelong friendship with Mike Hastings, who is still here, with whom I had so many discussions then and now. Good members have good staff, and that's no surprise. The easiest thing to do when you're introducing someone is to read their bio, and everyone will go, yeah, okay, that's nice. If you want to see Senator Mitchell's bio, there's a short version in the program. If you want to know more, go to Wikipedia. So I have no desire or interest or intention of telling an audience in Maine the background of Senator Mitchell. I mean, we all know he served in the Senate from 1980 to 1995. We all know that he turned down an appointment to the Supreme Court in order to work on health care for the country. Originally, Senator Mitchell was going to talk about the Middle East, which is, I guess, why they asked me to introduce him, because that's where I had my greatest exchanges with Senator Mitchell. And I had planned to go into his importance in trying to come up with an explanation for what led to the Second Intifada, when an international conference took place in October of 2000, and ultimately they selected Senator Mitchell to explain what happened. And what led to what became known as the Mitchell Report. I was going to talk about his work as the first person appointed by President Obama to deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict. And again, we're not talking about that, because there is so much more to him. If I had to summarize Senator Mitchell in one word, it would be integrity. In brief, regardless of whether you agree with him on any political issue, whatever his positions might be, anyone who knows him knows that they can trust him. And one of the themes that we heard this week was a concern, the lack of trust that is now taking place in our government, in our country. When you deal with Senator Mitchell, you know that he is completely honest and decent as a human being. During his tenure in the Senate, he enjoyed bipartisan respect because of his character and his moral values. One of his political foes once said of Senator Mitchell, "There is not a man, woman, or child in the Capitol who does not trust George Mitchell." For six consecutive years, he was voted the most respected member of the Senate by a bipartisan group of senior congressional aides. As I mentioned, in light of today's conditions, Senator Mitchell has decided to change his topic from the Middle East and talk instead about immigration and other issues related to that. It's an issue that has been at the center of American political experience since the very beginning. In 1798, Congress passed four bills that were then passed and signed into law by President John Adams, known ultimately as the Alien and Sedition Acts. The background behind these was, the rationale behind these was that at the time, Congress felt that the country was full. There was no room for anyone else to come. 1798. I think a few people arrived after. In addition, there was a concern that those recent immigrants might want to vote. And so efforts were made to deny them the ability to cast ballots. The Sedition Acts said that anyone who was critical of the government and the president could be thrown into jail because of it. So the issues we are now facing are by no means new. As a nation of immigrants, this affects all of us. There is not a person in this auditorium who cannot trace their own background, if they were born here themselves, to their ancestors who came from somewhere, and if they themselves came from somewhere. None of us ultimately trace our ancestors to this country. In my own case, my parents were refugees from Hitler's Germany. My stepfather was able to escape. Unfortunately, the rest of his family was not. He wound up leaving Germany, wound up in Palestine, then Scotland, and then came to this country. My mother also, together with my biologic father, were also refugees from Hitler's Germany. My stepfather and my mother met on Sand Beach. Yes, this Sand Beach. When my stepfather heard my mother speaking German and joined the conversation. The odds of this are zero. My wife's father fled from or left from what was then Poland, now Ukraine, wound up in Palestine, and entered this country in 1946. Her mother's parents came from Russia. As I'm sure he will tell us, Senator Mitchell's mother was born in Lebanon, and his father is of ethnic Irish descent and was adopted by a Lebanese family after he was orphaned. So every one of us has this shared experience, which is now at the crux of the American political dialogue. This is the last presentation of an absolutely remarkable week. There is simply no better person for whom to end this program than Senator George Mitchell.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for that warm reception. Thank you for your participation in this truly unique and outstanding program at College of the Atlantic. I join Ralph in congratulating Darren, Lynn, their whole team for organizing this conference, and I hope it's going to continue and expand in the years ahead. This college is a tremendous asset, not just to this community, this island, but to our entire state. And I'm pleased that so many have come to recognize that. I'm particularly grateful to Ralph for his generous introduction. I have known Ralph for a very long time, and one of the reasons he knows so many good stories and that he is such a good raconteur is that, as Darren said earlier, he served on the staff of Senator James Pearson. What Darren didn't say was Pearson served in the Senate during the First World War. So Ralph's had 100 years to collect all these stories and tell them, and he's been a wonderful friend and really, to me, a mentor. I really have learned a lot from him, listening to him, and it is a pleasure and an honor for me to have him introduce me. I've received, just in the few minutes before this program began, condolences from many of you regarding the death of my brother Johnny, which was widely publicized earlier this week. And he's the second of my brothers to pass away in the last couple of months. I gave both eulogies, and it inevitably led me to start thinking about family. And since my mother was an immigrant and my father the orphan son of immigrants, it led me to think about immigration. So that's really why I changed the subject, and I hope you're not offended. If anybody, there'll be a question and answer period afterwards, so if anybody wants to ask about the Middle East, I'm happy to discuss it at that time. Before he passed away, my brother Johnny told me and others, he said, I hope you'll keep telling stories about me because a person lives on through the stories about them. And he specifically asked me to tell at the funeral a couple of humorous stories about him, which I'd like to now tell in his honor before I get into the serious subject. I was born in Waterville. I had three older brothers. They were great athletes, each of them, in particular my brother Johnny, who was nationally famous. And then I came along and I was not as good an athlete as my brothers. Very early in life, I became known around our small town, hometown, as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers, which has persisted to this very day. I've often been asked since I left public life by reporters and interviewers and others, students when I speak at schools, what was the best moment for me? People think about it in terms of the Irish peace process and a lot of the legislation that was enacted when I was Senate Majority Leader. But in fact, the best day for me was the day after I was first elected in my own right to the Senate. After I was appointed, I had a short period of time before facing the main electorate, and I trailed by 36 percentage points in the polls. I was very lucky to come back and win the election, so it was a big surprise. And on election night, we had the traditional hotel ballroom gathering. It was the old Eastland Hotel in Portland. There was a large crowd. And when the result was finally announced, I was asked to come down and go to the podium to address the crowd. My brother Johnny had been accustomed to press attention, and he had a keen eye for cameras. So as I approached the podium, I saw him standing there, just as I'm standing in front of this microphone. He had elbowed my wife and daughter aside to get in a prime position because there are a lot of television cameras. So when I got to the podium, he refused to leave, and he draped his arm over my shoulder. And so I delivered my acceptance speech with my brother hanging on to me. It was a little bit physically awkward, but I got through it. And the next day, they had evening papers then. There was a Portland Evening Express, and on the front page was an enormous picture of me with my brother Johnny hanging on to me. And the caption said, Senator George Mitchell delivering his acceptance at his election, surprise election victory, being cheered on by an unidentified supporter. So I thought it was terrific, so I called the paper. I had him give me a big blow up of it. I signed it, had it framed, and I sent it to him. So the next time I went to his house, I looked around, I didn't see it. I said, well, maybe he's busy. I went back the next second, third time, no photo. Finally, I said to him, where's the picture? He said, it's upstairs in the attic under the 20 volumes of my scrapbooks. Now, the other story I like to tell about him, also a true story, is as Senate Majority Leader, I was once in Miami in the spring to speak at a political event. And one of the persons at the event turned out to be a man who owned the Miami Heat, the professional basketball team based there. And he said to me, they were playing the Boston Celtics that night. He knew I was from Maine, of course, and he said, maybe you'd like to come and see the game. I said, sure, I'd love to. So we went to see the Celtics play the Heat. There was a very famous Celtic who had played previously at Holy Cross named Bob Cousy, one of the most famous professional basketball players. So basketball fans will know who he was. And while in college, he at Holy Cross and my brother Johnny at the University of Rhode Island had developed a huge rivalry between the two of them. Cousy went on to become one of the greatest players in the NBA, and my brother went on to be the high school coach at Waterville. So on the way out after the game, the owner said to me, well, there's Bob Cousy leaving. Have you ever met him? I said, no. He said, would you like to meet him? I said, oh, yes, I'm a great fan of his, a great fan of the Celtics. So I went over. He said, well, come with me. And we went over, and he said to Cousy, he said, I'd like you to meet Senator Mitchell. He's the Senate Majority Leader. And Cousy looked at me kind of puzzled, and he said, well, do you represent Miami or Fort Lauderdale? The owner said, no, he's the United States Senate Majority Leader. Cousy still looked at me rather blankly. Then I said, Mr. Cousy, I'm Johnny Mitchell's brother. He broke into a big smile. He said, you're the Swisher's brother? I said, yes. He said, come here, let me give you a big hug. And I gave him a hug, and he whispered into my ear, your brother is the greatest. So that's the story I ended the eulogy with, and he really was the greatest. So now let me.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Senator George Mitchell is about to discuss immigration and its role in the story of America.
Let me talk a little bit about immigration. The movement of vast numbers of people across national borders, what we loosely call immigration, is one of the major problems confronting both developed and undeveloped countries all around the world. Because it is so vast and complicated, and the issues are not identical as between either sending or receiving countries or the immigrants themselves, it's not possible to cover the worldwide effects in a single speech. So today I will limit my remarks to its effect in our country. As Ralph noted in his introduction, every person in the Western Hemisphere is derived from someone who came from somewhere else. Human beings first appeared on Earth about 300,000 years ago in what we now call Africa. But they spread very slowly around the world, and it was not until about 15,000 years ago that small groups of people from Central Asia entered North America by crossing what was then the land bridge over what is now the Bering Strait, connecting Siberia and Alaska. They eventually spread east and south throughout all of North, Central, and South America, and they became what we now refer to as the Native Americans. About 500 years ago, the first European settlers came westward across the Atlantic. And for centuries, the Spanish, the Dutch, the British, and the French settlers fought among themselves and with the Native Americans for control of North America. And from the very beginning, among all of them, there was racism, demonization, stereotyping, and discrimination, especially as to Africans, who were the only group brought involuntarily to America in chains and for centuries lived in slavery and discrimination. After our country was established, negative attitudes persisted, as Ralph also described when he talked about the Alien and Sedition Acts. They were countered somewhat by the new nation's need for people to fill a vast continent. And after the Alien and Sedition Acts, nearly a century passed before the first specifically restrictive immigration laws were passed. In 1880, in reaction to the entry of thousands of Chinese workers who were employed in the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, Congress enacted the first exclusionary law. Nowadays, Congress has developed an aptitude for naming bills with fancy titles that often are the opposite of what the bills actually do. Back then, they were more blunt. That first law was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. In 1905, San Francisco was devastated by an earthquake and major fires. Many buildings were destroyed, including most of the schools. To help them deal with the problem, the city then passed an ordinance which denied any child of Japanese descent, even those born in the United States, from entering the public schools of San Francisco. They were required to attend Asian segregated schools. To demonstrate just how widespread discrimination always has been, many of the Japanese parents were doubly upset. First, they were upset that the children could not go to school with white Americans, even though they were citizens. But secondly, they were really angry that their children had to go to school with Chinese and Koreans, who the Japanese regarded as inferior. When millions of Irish, like my father's parents, fled famine and poverty in their country, they were harshly discriminated against in the United States. Across the cities of America, particularly on the East Coast, signs read, "Irish need not apply," and cartoons were published, including magazines and newspapers in Maine, which showed the body of an ape and the face of an Irishman, depicting and describing them as human. Also subject to discrimination were Italian immigrants, as the crimes of a few were stereotyped on all. And so also, in their turn, were most other ethnic and religious migrants. The Ku Klux Klan is best remembered for its violence against African Americans in the South in the late 19th century. But the Klan reached its peak of influence in the North in the early 20th century in campaigns of extreme hostility to Catholics and Jews. Indeed, other than African Americans, no group of Americans has suffered from discrimination longer, with greater intensity in every aspect of their lives than have Jews. And yet, tremendous contributions have been made to and for our country by members of each of these groups. The earliest of them got their hands on the bottom rung of the ladder of American success, and they pulled themselves up. And their children and grandchildren, people like me, stood on their shoulders and climbed even higher, in some cases, to the pinnacles of success. Every rational American knows that we cannot return to open immigration. There must be realistic limits on how many people can enter and who they are. And we as Americans must work together on how we can do that and at the same time live up to our principles as a just, open, and welcoming society. The emphasis now is on who we want to keep out and who we want to throw out. But we also should focus on who we want to enter, how we can continue to replenish our society with new people to their benefit and to ours. We don't need walls to keep people out. We don't pursue policies to try to recreate a distant past that is now viewed by many through rose-colored glasses. In our deeply polarized society and politics, it will be difficult to find common ground, but it's not impossible. In 2013, just 5 years ago, 8 United States senators, 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats, drafted legislation that passed the Senate with a wide bipartisan majority. It wasn't perfect by anyone's standards because it required compromise from 2 sharply competing points of view. But it was a reasonable compromise that would have significantly improved the then current law. If it had been brought up to a vote in the House of Representatives, it undoubtedly would have passed by a similarly wide bipartisan majority. But the Speaker of the House refused to permit the House to vote on it, in part because it would have passed, and the bill died. We need another bipartisan effort, and we need legislative decisions made based on what's best for the country, not what's best for one or the other political party. From the very beginning, our country has been enriched by new people, new ideas, new energy, new vision, and it continues to this day. In 2016, 7 Americans received Nobel Prizes. 6 were immigrants. 3 of our most valuable and successful business enterprises, indeed among the most successful in all of human history, are Apple, Amazon, and Google. Apple was created by Steve Jobs, whose father was born in Syria. Amazon was created by Jeff Bezos, whose adoptive father was born in Cuba, and a co-founder of Google was Sergey Brin, who himself was born in Russia. As you drive home tonight, ask yourself 2 questions. Would we be a better country if they had not been admitted? And secondly, of equal importance, what do you think the chances are that if Steve Jobs had lived his entire life in Syria, he would have created Apple, or Jeff Bezos in Cuba, or Sergey Brin in Russia. Genius knows no language, no race, no religion. It can be found wherever human beings exist, but it is more likely to flourish where there is freedom, education, and opportunity for all, where innovation is encouraged and success is celebrated. In other words, a place like America. We have made many mistakes. We have been through some very difficult struggles, but we have emerged from every crisis a better, stronger, more free, more diverse country. Our economy is by far the largest and the strongest in the world. Our military strength is unequaled, and although we comprise only 5% of the world's population, 9 of the 10 most valuable business brands in the world are American, as are 15 of the top-ranked 20 universities. 91% of all online searches are done through American companies, and 99% of smartphones are on American-made operating systems. I believe that a major contributor to our success is that the strength of America lies ultimately in our ideals. Military power and economic strength are obviously important, critical. But in the United States, they have been infused with the ideals that are the basis and the promise of American life. They're not easily summarized, but surely they include the sovereignty of the people, individual liberty, our highest value, opportunity for every member of society, an independent judicial system, and the rule of law applied equally to all and crucially applied to the government itself. It is our commitment to those ideals that makes us Americans, not our race, not our religion, not our heritage, not our color. It's our commitment to the ideals of freedom and justice. Our Constitution is more than just a compilation of laws and procedures. It's a statement of our ideals, of our values, especially equal justice, equal rights, equal opportunity. We Americans have much to be concerned about here at home and abroad, but we have much more to be thankful for. And we now need the wisdom and the strength to extend education, jobs, and hope to more and more people in our country and around the world. I want to close with two immigrant stories that are personal to me. The first is about the man I call the real George Mitchell. A long time ago, in a tiny village in the hills of Greece, a boy named Savas Paraskevopoulos worked as a goat herder. Although uneducated, he was smart and ambitious. He wanted wider opportunity, so at the age of 20, he left for America. In America, Savas found work on the construction of the railroads that were needed to span a large continent. He was a good worker, and at the end of the first week, he was paid. But the Irish paymaster said to him that his name was too long and too hard to spell or to pronounce, so he told him to get a new name. Savas said to the supervisor, "What's your name?" And the Irishman answered, "Mike Mitchell." Savas said, "Okay, from now on, that will be my name." And it was. Soon, young Mike Mitchell wanted to settle down, so he moved to Galveston, Texas, and there he opened a shoeshine shop and spent his life shining shoes. He married, and he and his wife had a son they named George. Like his father, George was smart and ambitious. He went to Texas A&M. He became an engineer. He entered the oil and gas business, where he became successful and very wealthy. 25 years ago, the United States imported most of the oil it consumed, much of it from the Middle East. 8 American presidents pledged to make the United States energy independent. But it didn't happen until George Mitchell got involved. After years of study, analysis, and trial and error, he conceived the practice that has become known as fracking and related drilling concepts. And as a result, the United States has become the world's largest producer of oil and gas, revolutionizing not just the energy industry, but our own economy. The son of a goat herder from a village in Greece did what 8 American presidents could not do. I first met him when I was a Senate Majority Leader, and he called me to jokingly complain that he was receiving a lot of my mail. I told him that I wouldn't mind getting some of his mail, especially his bank account. There's room for legitimate debate, and is ongoing in the country, over the extent to which fracking should be regulated to prevent harmful consequences. But the economic significance of his work is beyond doubt. And long after I have been forgotten, that man, the man I call the real George Mitchell, would be remembered because, in a real and tangible sense, he changed the world. Another person who went through a name change to become a George Mitchell was my father. His parents were born in Ireland. They became part of one of the great migrations in all of human history as millions of Irish fled famine and poverty, crossed the Atlantic in search of freedom and opportunity in the new world. My father never knew his parents. His mother died. His father couldn't care for the children, and so my father and his siblings were raised in orphanages. After several years there, he was adopted by an elderly, childless couple from Waterville. They were immigrants who, on arrival, had changed their names to Mitchell, and they named their adopted son George. He left school after the 3rd grade. He worked a long, hard life as a laborer and ended up as a janitor at Colby College. My parents were very poor and died penniless. But in their minds, they were successful because each of their children got an education, and then, thanks to the openness of American society, each lived a life that was completely outside of my parents' imagination. My father said very little, and he never, ever spoke about his early years. On the morning I was to leave home to go away to college, he sat me down at the kitchen table. He was wearing his work clothes. My mother had just returned from work on the night shift at a textile mill, and she was covered with lint. My father said to me, in words I will never forget, "You're a smart young boy. I know you're going to do well. I want you now to take a good look at your mother, take a good look at me, and wherever you go, whatever you do, don't you ever forget where you came from." I never have. I don't know most of you personally, but I'm certain that in this room, as in almost every American audience, there are lots of similar stories. And I hope that each of you will never forget where you came from. My mother was born to a Christian family in Lebanon. At the age of 16, she followed 2 of her sisters and left for America. There, by chance, she ended up in Waterville, living next door to my father's family. They met, and my parents were married. Often, as we sat at the kitchen table, my mother said to the 5 of us children, "You should see Lebanon. It's so beautiful. The ocean, the mountains, even the flowers smell better." She returned only once, late in her life, with my sister. She returned to the small mountain village where she grew up, was welcomed with a celebration, where she was asked to say a few words. With a smile on her face, tears in her eyes, and a loud, clear voice, she said, "You should see America. It's so beautiful. The ocean, the mountains, even the flowers smell better." She said, "Oh, America, my America." She worked nights in a textile mill for half a century. She could not read or write. She knew nothing of history or politics. But she understood clearly the meaning of America. Freedom for her and her family, opportunity for her children. In her heart and in her mind, she was as much an American as those who came over on the Mayflower. To me, no one has ever said it better. Oh, America, my America. As do all humans, we Americans have many faults. Here, they're right out in the open for all to see and debate. Nationally, as a society, we've made many tragic mistakes, some by good people who thought they were doing the right thing, even as they were badly mistaken. So from our history, both the good and the bad, I draw two lessons. The first is humility. We should be ever mindful of our own fallibility and therefore careful in our words, in our decisions, and in our actions, especially as we collectively as Americans are the dominant world power, influencing not just the lives of the people of this country, but the lives of people in every part of the world. Even the best among us are often wrong. The second lesson is one of hope and optimism. Despite our many mistakes, despite our obvious serious imperfections, the United States of America remains to me a place of freedom and opportunity, and we are so fortunate to be citizens of a society which is still the most free, the most open, the most just in all of human history. And our task is to work to keep it that way. Thank you all very much for having me here this evening.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Senator George Mitchell will now answer questions from the audience.
Thank you.
You're still up for a few questions, right? Yeah?
Go ahead.
Questions from the audience. We're going to keep them to two, maybe three, depending on how short you make the question.
I think the real problem, Darren, is in the length of the answers, not in the length of the questions.
Anyone?
What an inspiring speech, Senator. Thank you. I was a young speechwriter in the Clinton White House in 1998. It was a pretty tough year for the Clinton White House, but there was a real ray of light in March when the Good Friday Accords were negotiated, and you were so important in that and so inspiring to all of us. And it was the beginning of a feeling that borders were becoming more porous, and the specific border between the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland was the border in question. That border's getting a little less porous now. And with Brexit coming, we're all wondering what will happen in that specific part of Europe. It's a place where it feels like it's Europe on one side and not so much on the other. So are the troubles coming back, in your opinion?
Brexit was a democratically taken decision in a free and fair election, and therefore I believe must be respected, even though I believe it is a, history will prove it to be a profound mistake on the part of the United Kingdom. I think that's becoming increasingly obvious, and once they reach a conclusion of the negotiations, no matter how they settle it, the economy of the United Kingdom will suffer serious long-term damage. But they voted on it. The principal victims will be the people of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, who did not vote for it, who adamantly opposed Brexit and remain a part of the European Union. Because unless a special exception is made with respect to the Irish-English or Irish-British relationship, Ireland's economy, which is heavily integrated into that of the United Kingdom, will suffer far more than even the UK economy. Keep in mind, the UK has 65 million people. It's got the second largest economy in Europe after Germany. Ireland has 5 million people. It's a very small country. And it will be a supreme irony that after 800 years of domination of Ireland, the United Kingdom, then less than a century after Ireland gains its independence, an action is taken which has such a devastating effect on the Irish economy. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and the European Union made a public commitment last December that whatever the outcome of their negotiations, there would not be a resumption of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We accept that promise, but we insist that they keep it. And what has happened in the long months since is that it's easy to say you'll do things. It's really hard sometimes to do what you said you'd do. And this is a classic example. It's highly complex, very technical, but the fact of the matter is they have not yet found a formula that will enable them to meet all of the other objectives and keep the promise that they made. The situation in Northern Ireland is compounded by the fact that Northern Ireland, one of four constituent parts of the United Kingdom, along with Scotland, Wales, and England, voted strongly against Brexit and doesn't want a return to a hard border. And a return would be devastating. It's already complex enough in Northern Ireland. The government created as a result of the agreement, a power-sharing government in Northern Ireland, has not functioned for a year and a half over other unrelated issues. Fortunately, the violence has not resumed, but no one can ever say for sure in human affairs with certainty it won't happen. Things happen in life, and the longer it goes with the uncertainty over the border and the inability of the two governing parties to come together, the greater the possibility of return to violence. When I first went there, it was a militarized border. Checkpoints, barbed wire, troop carriers, men in uniform carrying machine guns. Now it's completely open. It's like driving from Maine to New Hampshire. And the most remarkable positive effect has been the demolition of the demonization and the stereotyping that had existed on both sides. I was shocked when I first went there to find that people who lived within 1,000 yards of the border had never crossed it. And so on each side, there were perceptions of the other that were rooted in centuries-old practices. They're completely out of date now, and yet they lingered because a wall kept them apart. Once that came down, there has been a tremendous degree of interaction, goods traveling across the border, people going back and forth. And now they see each other for what they are, fellow human beings, not other, someone to be demonized, despised, and put down. And so I think it'll be an immense tragedy. Brexit will, I think, be an immense tragedy on several levels, including in Ireland, but I hope and pray that the British government and the European Union will get past the sort of public inflammatory language and settle into serious, constructive, sober negotiations to try to find an arrangement that can work for all of the people involved.
It will be so much more comfortable down in the garden, which
I did want to say, Darren.
Yes.
I noticed those people lucky enough to be sitting outside.
Yeah.
If this were an airplane, you'd be first class.
That's right. But let's do one more question
fine.
Inside.
That's
all right.
Hi, Senator Mitchell, Abby Moffitt. In any case, we just spent some time in Israel, and we discovered so much patriotism in that country. And even among the young people, they felt such a privilege to be part of the country. The experiences they had in the military were phenomenal. What would you do to promote patriotism in this country, and what are your thoughts about young people doing service, not necessarily military, but some kind of service after high school?
I have spent a great deal of time in Israel. I did 2 tours of duty in the Middle East, and there is truly a remarkable sense of patriotism. However, it's relatively easy to do in a largely homogeneous and small society, particularly one with the long history of oppression that Jews have faced. Much more difficult in a very large, diverse country such as ours. While I was in the Senate, I explored with a group of other senators the possibility of not reinstating the draft, but creating a public service alternative for all young people. And the hard reality that we came up with is that this is such a big country. We now have 325 million Americans, and in just a few decades, by 2050, there'll be 440 million Americans, that the numbers of young people eligible were so daunting that the administrative task would be simply overwhelming to try to create a national program that would have attempted to encourage service not just in a military sense, although I served in the military, and it was one of the great experiences of my life. We just don't need that many, and we have a volunteer army now that has many other assets to it, although there are disadvantages. But the ways in which people can contribute to their society to their personal benefit, because the motivating factor, which I'm sure you're getting at, is all of us go through life, and there is an innate human drive to succeed and excel by however one defines success, wealth, status, the acquisition of things. But the reality is the more of those you acquire, the more you come to realize that there must be more to life than that. And the real satisfaction in life comes from engaging with others in an effort that is larger than one's self-interest. That makes one feel a part of a group or a community or society. That's one of the appeals of religion. It's one of the appeals of nationalism. It's one of the appeals of local social groups. Human beings are naturally social beings. And so we've not been able to figure out how to do in this country because of the sheer size and diversity. But one of the things I speak at universities quite a lot, and I encourage young people to seek out opportunities to engage in public service on their own as a way of gaining fulfillment in life. And I have to say that my wife and I are blessed with 2 children. We have 1 20-year-old and 1 17-year-old. I think they and children their age are going to live a life much better than ours, more opportunity, hopefully, and more chance to do good things for others in the way that you describe. But we haven't quite figured out as a society how to do it. And it may best be left, because this is such a big, diverse country, to smaller local units at the community or state level to figure out ways to do that. Thank you all very much. Great to be here with you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Senator George Mitchell. He talked about immigration in modern America. He recently spoke at the 2018 Champlain Institute, hosted by College of the Atlantic. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock, Limbic System, and This Will Destroy You. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.